contact with the Times, and I've been wanting to get a box, you know, black outline box that states how many accidents we had this week, how many, I hate to say it, deaths, but let's face it, and injuries. So it was skipped out. This is what NAD is all about, is the education, get education out to the people. And we need your help to get the laws there so we can help educate the people that they're going to get caught. And we don't want them on our roads. And this is, we're going to work on education, and it is in the schools. My grandson came home, and he's in the sixth grade, and he was so proud because he knew all about this already. And he could answer some questions at this, I forgot the man's name that was at the school that day, but he said, and all the kids in school was really enthused about it. So education in school is just, is great, because this is where it starts. And I can't think very well. And about the age, I've been doing a lot of studying on that, and I do think that it should be restored back to 21. At first I had a lot of doubts, because I was thinking they're going to drive around in their cars and drink anyhow, which we know they do. The kids under 18 drive around and drink. But another thing, if we make a stricter law on having open beer cans and bottles and stuff in the car, will help. Because you drive down the street and you look in another car, and here they are drinking a beer, just like, you know, and they're brought up this way. This is our generation has been brought up with the TV, all your soap operas, all your advertising. If you don't drink beer, you can't play football. You know, I mean, this is just about it. It's you know, it's just that. And out of I was talking to the doctors at the hospitals, that 80 and 90% of their emergency room is alcohol related. They couldn't break it down to accidents, but it's almost all of it. And that was from the doctors in the emergency room. And this is just ridiculous. And I like this idea of this curfew. It's been proven in, I think it was Maryland, that it really does help to keep people under a certain age off the streets between 9 and 6 or whatever. And as far as C Street, I'd like to see them close it. It's terrible in through there. And we were in Juneau, and we really enjoyed our visit and meeting a lot of the legislators, and we thought we made a big headway. And I heard a lot of rumors, and I got mad, and I guess I wrote a letter that some of them thought I meant everybody, and I sure didn't. It's some of these legislators that are very soft. Of course, we know you folks are all with us, but there are a few of them that we have to really get down and talk to. And I'm going back to Juneau with our MAD program and try to get to some of these that we know that are, you know, a little bit soft. And what got me mad, and I'm mad now, and I think we are, since February 10th, there's been 4 deaths and 23 injuries. Now that's just only 2 months, and this is only ones that I've heard about in Anchorage alone. This isn't the state or anything, and I also happen to know that 7 of those injuries haven't even been in the paper, and they're all drunk drivers. And I think, you know, this has made us outraged. And in this last week, after this last accident, it has been so bad, my phone, the MAD's phone, has rang off the hook day and night. There's been 3 of us answering the phones constantly up until in all hours of the night. People are so outraged over this. And so anything that you can do, we really want the laws there. And if the laws would have been there this past week, or for the last 2 months, for the last any time, well, but especially this last week on this awful one that happened, this Dennis Bigler would be alive today. That they let this guy out, and there was just no excuse to let him out. And we've got to do something with the system there. I mean, this one just outraged me till I threw a fit. I was calling the papers and the TVs and everybody I knew, and everybody was calling me. My house has been a regular war over this because it's so terrible. So all I'm asking is to everybody, just try to get the legislators, get us our laws, let's get them enforced, and I'm for everything. And if you get them passed, we'll make sure that it's made public so everyone will be afraid to drive. And just pass the law so we can enforce them, and I can't say no more right now.
Well, thank you very much, June. June? I do want to say that all of us respect you for what you have done, and we've sympathized with you from the time of that your grandchildren were killed. But I personally want to say that I think you've performed a real service, because it takes a turned-on community, it takes the kind of leadership you've provided to get a citizen grassroots effort to get results. Because last year, when we're dealing with some of these issues and some of the same proposals were before us, there was no citizens group, there was no pressure, and so on. Let me say, from the standpoint of one legislator, that it doesn't bother me when you write the letter, which I might even interpret as being directed at me, when Jerry Flew has cartoons in the Anchorage Times and Atwood writes editorials saying the Senate State Affairs Committee is sitting in the 21 age drinking bill. I'm doing my job. So long as I feel I'm being honest and so on, I think that's fine. Keep the pressure up. Keep applying it. I am concerned, not with one piece of legislation. We could pass the 21-year drinking bill and ignore all the other things, and the chances are the mayhem will continue. We can pass the bill increasing the penalties, but as Dr. Kelso so well put before us, that probably will not act as a sufficient deterrent. And this is why we're looking at the entire problem. We want to look at sort of a whole package of measures that we can take, and your testimony and some of your suggestions add to the kinds of things that we need to consider. And I personally do appreciate your efforts, and I'm sure I can speak for Pat and I
do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, I'm going to take the lady in back next. Yes, you. On the side. You can do it with shoes, without shoes. You can wear a hat if you wish. It doesn't matter.
My name is Celia Warrior. I head up the chair from Child Molestation. I only have one comment, short comment, that later on. What I'm here for is on the week of driving and raising the drinking age to 21. I wrote this down, so I don't feel so bad to be. It won't come out terrible that way, you know, it's the way I feel. I really have to. I hope you don't mind. This is right here. I'm raising my drinking age from 19 to 21. I'm thoroughly supported for the reasons I feel more outlook, confidence for our young up to even a large percentage above the age of 21 has greatly decreased in the past 10 to 20 years. It seems at present time to be limitless opportunities for our society after work, sports activities, parties, dances, etc. The most popular beverage to relax with is alcohol. There is estimated 6 to 10 million alcoholics in the United States today. 30,000 deaths attributed to alcohol, and approximately 1.5 million alcohol automobile-related injuries caused by alcohol. It's been expressed by medical studies that it decreases the lifespan from 10 to 20 years. I feel that one way we can help our public awareness and public awareness is by extending it into the high schools and colleges. I don't mean by just short discussions of literature. I mean by films that were similar to the military films, the U.S. government shown to young services and social diseases, DP and such. I think that we need to, on the same line, let's show our young people the harsh, ugly side of alcoholism from taking them on a tour by film or supporting them to the detox centers, hospitals, psychiatric wards, emotional listening to the streets and alleyways. Show them medical evidence, show pictures of men, women, with liver problems in spite of everybody all over their shoulders, from portal cirrhosis, alcohol crisis. Show people put out of DTs, being combated with comatose, show the blackouts and the convulsions. Show them alcohol, all its...
You're doing just fine.
Show me alcoholics going through withdrawals, have visual and audio elucidations, often after a long drinking spree, and in mental conditions they see people that are threatening them. They're trying to threaten that they have a distorted figure to elbows and people, and that they tend toward suicide or even murderous thoughts. I know my dad was an alcoholic, but I know that that drinking and drugs. And show where they have no regard for their personal hygiene, their carelessness for cigarettes. When they burn their fingers, and sometimes they burn down their house with their loved ones. And there are young people who have talks with doctors, the paramedics, police officers who deal daily with alcoholism. I'm showing aftermath of tragic accidents that can see firsthand of complications from alcoholism, giving a tour of our jails, the smell, the dry heat, the whole nine yards, then see the bloody conditions. Young teenagers today, they're young teenagers being normal. They like to get out and like to brag. They like to break up their cars and impress their girlfriends. They like to get behind the wheel. And when there's a certain mentality that people get behind the wheels when they're drinking, they think they can do anything in the world, or even the whole world at their disposal. And they can go out there and make them just be regular dukes of hazard. And their family gets very destructive for young people. See these types of shows. And some people are 60 years old, act like teenagers, and there's some people who are teenagers who are responsible in this world. I'm not just trying to lump them all in one sense. I mean, it's fun, but it's a dangerous thing anyway. Unless they're using this method, young people show them, educate them about alcoholism even before they get to the age where they'd be tempted to drink and drive. I'll give you a personal testimony. It's not very pretty, but I don't know how it's going to thank on me or anything, but I have a son that's 17 years old. He wants to drive and drink more than anything in the world. He's been a runaway, chronic runaway. My husband's like, go get him numerous times. He's overdosed. He's been staying around the parking lot. He's got two cars. John no place to live. He wants to sleep in his car. He wants to drive more than anything in this whole wide world. He puts that before us. This is top priority. He came in the house one night and he was drunk and drinking. I don't know what he was doing. But he wanted to take a bath late at night before he left the last time. He wanted to take a bath, so I had to go ahead and let him. the 11 o'clock at night, and she got there, and the tourist said, I'm going to think about this late tonight anymore. And that says, I don't even know who it was, but he's too big, he's bigger than me, he's got 6 foot. So I'm going to try to keep it up to the back, or I don't even know what to do, I'm just mad. Fast the back, I guess. And my husband came at that time, my husband's 6 foot three, he's a very extremely powerful man. I guess he saw where there were 17 years of deletery out and everything. And he laid a few groups on my son. He put him down and had his hand behind his back and he hit him a couple times in the shoulder and he hit him in the jaw. He said, he's getting out the front door. He says, Tori, that, I guess it was the last straw, I don't know. Because he mixed me in a toilet down to the bottle, salt and batter. Because my husband, he was really hurt. So we were going to see it on through. I don't know. And down the last few steps, I don't know if the counselor was going to put the scoop it, but he's still sleeping in his car, he's been hearing me out. I tried to get all the same challenge, talk to him. He's a good boy, he's got a lot of potential. He just wants to drive. And he said if we drop the charges, if he could drop the charges against my husband, he would sign to him to have a license. All he wants to do is get out there and drive that car. He's got this old car, he sleeps in it, sleeping bag, and he's got them, he's laid money down. And he works, and he's always worked. I give him my kids, always try to work. But we're not going to give in to him, because my son showing that kind of maturity, he's the last person in the world that should be on that road. He just works in it. Once the party takes all his money, puts him in the car.
I sympathize with you totally, and I'm sure you're here because you want to help others deal with the situation, and so we can avoid this kind of thing from happening. So I'd like to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. Do you think that your son would be responsive if we had a law and strict enforcement where he would be afraid that he would lose his car if he were apprehended driving while drunk? Would that make a difference to him?
It's possible. My husband said that he came around in my car for this bound to charge his car and threatened to intimidate me on the phone. And let's see, my take his car away and get him in the home. But he's already so mad. We're trying to keep the communication open right now. Right now, one car doesn't work, and I don't know what he's doing with the other one. He's disagreeing with him. He's had the license changed illegally. One of them, we went up to see Kenny Simpson of the state troopers, and we had the license, and they signed the license change, to his thing. I don't know how they did it, but we had to switch back over to the original owner's thing. Now it's got a different license on there.
You say your boy is 17.
Yes.
How long has he been drinking, so far as you know?
Well, he started in, something you don't want to face it, you want to kind of close your eyes to, but it's been, he told me he's been taking a week of trying marijuana in junior high, and he's daydreaming and stuff like that. He's not a sheep in this world, he's a big scale or model, or he's extremely intelligent.
At what stage did you know that he was into alcohol?
I think it's when he overdosed that time, and friends of his called, and they called the paramedics over there.
How old was he then?
16.
Do you have any idea how he acquires alcohol since he's underage?
He said that he can get it anywhere he wants. He said he could get drugs. He said he could stand on East Street corner and not feel it. And people would offer drinks and booze. He could go out. See, he gets paid. He always works. Like I said, since he's 12 years old, he's pulling his coin collection. Silver nugget to get that car one time. He was dead. He just obsessed with it. And all of it. And so hard to answer.
See, this is part of my concern is that we have some statistics on the on fatalities, and the statistics for 1981, for instance, show that there were 11 drivers 18 and under who were involved in fatal alcohol-related accidents, four age 19 and two age 20, so that we seem to have a problem actually at the illegal drinking age. I mean, that seems to where the most crucial problem is.
We can get that one car driving, you can drive it, you know, we can try to drive it. And he said that he could get beer. See, he does work, he does pay his buddies, and they go by the booze, you know, they can buy him stuff, and a lot of times they rip them off and ends up without his wallet or something. But he never sees them out. It's right back,
Yeah.
Ask for more. Right now, this is staying pretty straight. I don't want to see.
Well,
I don't know. I guess it's a support thing.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very helpful. I know it's tough on you, but this was very good testimony, and I really appreciate your being with us.
I really do think that military things are showing kids what it really is one of the best, I think, a very productive method of stopping drinking alcoholism, you know, and driving. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Al Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-A-U-L-C. And I just heard about this meeting last night. I live about 100 miles north of here, so I had to rush down here this morning. I was not prepared to say what I'd like to say, but I'll try and be brief. I admire and I'm proud of June and everything she's doing, but I do have to disagree on a couple of the points with her. First, I'm totally personally against raising the liquor age to 21, and I have several reasons for it. And I'm also against putting a curfew on our young people. And on the lower 48, I think it works beautiful, the 21 and the curfew both until then. Up here, we have a different way of life, different type of people, different everything. And all we're doing is telling our young people that they are irresponsible, poor citizens that we don't really want up here when we say 21, you know, after being 19, and putting curfews on them. A lot of kids, it used to aggravate me to see kids out at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I realized they were sleeping during the day the same time their parents were sleeping during the day. It didn't aggravate me so much. I realized their parents were up when they were up. Several years ago, I tried to run a teen dance out in Eagle River for the kids out there because there was nothing for kids to do. I run it for the Lions Club. I had to give it up because of alcohol. Because I could not get enough volunteers to assist me with the teen dances, and the kids were getting too much alcohol, and they were getting it from adults, people like you and myself, in their cars, drive up there and sell it to these 15, 16, 17-year-olds, no qualms whatsoever, and I couldn't control it in any way. I had to be inside the building watching the kids. I couldn't be out in the parking lot. Sometimes I'd catch the adults passing the booze through the windows. but all I could do was slam the window down on her wrists. Raising it to 21 is not going to prove anything. Those kids are going to get it. All it's going to do is give a bigger market for the adults to sell booze to illegally. Prohibition is all it is. And the bootleggers are going to make more money because it was a 19 to 21 age group that wants the booze, they want to get it from the bootleggers.
Yeah, if may I interrupt? The concern that we have, of course, in proposals to raise the drinking age, to establish a curfew, is that there is a high incidence of irresponsible driving, irresponsible drinking on the part of these young people. Now, I'm one of those who feels that we should not, if we can possibly avoid it, punish 5,000, 20,000 law-abiding, good kids because of transgressions on the part of a small number. However, the question is, how do we deal with the situation, with the kind of an issue we just had presented to us? All right.
The legislature, juvenile officials, Anchorage officials, the police department have got to go to civic organizations, the Lions Club, Yale, what have you, and find out how civic they really are. If they're civic on prom night, on graduation night, and such as that, they'll get out with the police force and set up checkpoints all over the city. And it works beautiful. I watched it. I happened to go through Tijuana, Mexico on a Christmas Eve. And they had all these people out there on the intersections stopping the cars. And they check you. If you've been drinking, pull the car over the side and they take you home. It worked beautiful. No problems. And they had as much traffic in Tijuana that night as we have any night here in Anchorage. And yet everything flowed good. I got stopped about 7 times just going a short distance across town. But they were all real nice people that stopped them. Very convenient and everything. Wanted to see if you're having a good Christmas Eve. And the same thing can be done on special events for the schools. Put up a few roadblocks. That's all. It works. Take the kids home to their parents. You're going to curb a large percentage of that drinking right there. Or driving.
What about taking the cars away?
Oh, that's great. I think it's wonderful. You know, I watched them down there in Florida taking their drug cars away. In California, they're taking the smugglers' cars away, whether they're smuggling aliens or drugs or whatever. And sure, those guys are making big bucks, so they can run out and buy another one. But in the same sense, if the state of Alaska confiscates all these vehicles, up here, it's a different way of life. You're going to hurt people. All right, so the car is finance. And that's mumbo-jumbo what's going on right now. So what? The finance company has the first chance to buy the vehicle back at a price that the state of Alaska sets. And if they don't want to buy it back, then the state can sell it for the low wholesale price on the market.
What if the car is owned by someone else?
He has the option of buying it back. To teach them not to let the drunk driver drive the damn thing.
What if the car is owned by what if the car is owned by the husband and there's a woman with 2 little children and they have no other transportation?
I'm giving
you the points
right,
that are
yes.
being thrown at me
okay.
in Juneau.
My point is, we've got to set up some kind of a honorable squeal law, you know, where a wife can squeal on her husband, a husband can squeal on his wife, a friend can squeal on a friend. You know. I've been a victim many times of drunk driving, drunk drivers, and I have a very dear friend that owns 2 of the best drug and alcohol centers in Southern California. And I spend all my time talking to him, trying to convince the man to use his own clinic. In the 5 years I've known him, I've only seen him sober once in 5 years. He's a bad, drunk, alcoholic, whatever. He's bad. He drives violently. He doesn't drive like a sane man, he drives violently. And he'll kill somebody, then he'll realize he's a drunk. You know? But why can't a friend, a wife, or a husband, or somebody turn that person in? We've had two deaths just here recently, you know, where the spouses were pleading for help. And I know for a fact that one spouse was told, leave it alone or you'll end up in jail. That's right. Because our Alaska laws protect our drunks. We do have laws to protect the drunks. The spouse can't turn the spouse in. And that's bad business. Putting drunks in our jails here are no good. First, it's an imposition on the employees of the jail. It's not fair to them, because that's not what they're there for. They're for law enforcement. And drug abuse is a different feel altogether. Besides, I think drunks are a bad influence on our criminals.
Yeah. Now, what are you saying? What should we do with them? Not put them in jail?
Bring these surplus camps down here,
oh,
set
okay.
them up in different areas. And when a drunk is found driving on the road, lock them up right there. I watched a drunk get stopped by a cop in Eagle River. They brought him to Anchorage and booked him, and they went back out, and they're doing the paperwork when the drunk comes back out there, gets in his car, and drives off. They're still doing the paperwork on his case.
Let me put a question to Alan Bailey, who's the municipal prosecutor at this point. One of the issues that has been raised a number of times is the setting up of roadblocks. Can that be done legally in Alaska? Do we need statutory authority to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I've been doing some research on my own and at the suggestion of some other people for a while now on the use of roadblocks, or as they're called, checkpoints for enforcement. Based on the case authority from the U.S. Supreme Court, and standards that have been devised by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, I think they can be legally set up if they're administered properly and for the proper purpose, and they cause only a minimal intrusion on the drivers going on the particular street, except for the drunks, of course. I think they would be upheld by the federal courts. Now, whether the Alaska Supreme Court would follow that or not is open to speculation. Generally, in this kind of legal question, the Alaska Supreme Court has followed the federal courts, and that would be in the area of search and seizure law. And I think very probably this kind of activity would be upheld if it's conducted properly.
Under existing law, do we need more statutory authority, or should we have more specific authority than what we may have?
I think it can be done under existing law. It's simply an enforcement device, and really the statutes don't address themselves to enforcement to a great extent. The problem with legislating it is that if you leave something out, or if you inadvertently include
right.
something that shouldn't be in there, then the courts can bounce us on a technical interpretation of the statute, where if we did it within constitutional guidelines, we might have better luck. Now, of course, if some kind of state support or assistance were contemplated to municipalities, then that would have to be provided for either by statute or regulation, or you know, through a grant from this highway safety planning.
Thank you.
The boroughs and states have control of the roads. Use that control to set up roadblocks. The road safety check or whatever. But the biggest thing is keep a smile on a face, you know? Don't have a negative attitude when you stop the car. And everything works beautifully and flows right through. I've seen it work.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down here. Gentleman in the front row. Do you have to go also? You'll come next. I'm trying not to limit anyone's time, but I know that a number of people want to get out before noon, so I hope those who are called upon before noon will address us as quickly, as briefly as possible. Please go ahead.
Senator Fisher, Senator Rody, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Landers. I'm here with someone like June. I have two hats on also. I'm not a victim. I'm a traffic engineer with the State Department of Transportation. Part of my duties are to investigate fatality accidents. I investigate between 40 and 50 per year in the area about 100-mile radius of Anchorage. And unfortunately, the numbers that have been quoted here on the paper are from the paper, about 80% are true. About 80% of fatal accidents I investigate are alcohol related. Whether it's the innocent person that's killed or the guilty person that's killed is still alcohol related. And here also, another hat on, I'm the vice president of MAD and a very concerned citizen. I listened to Dr. Kelso give his presentation, and it was very elucidating in the breakdown. MAD is here for some of the points that he brought out, and MAD is here for stronger points to emphasize some of the points. What people have been hearing from MAD, and perhaps what yourselves have been hearing, is we want a very strong deterrence. That's true, we do. We want a very strong deterrence. We're of the belief, and although we're not all professionals in all fields involved with MAD, we're of the belief that until a person actually physically wants to be himself rehabilitated, no matter what you do to him, you're not going to rehabilitate him. We've heard Judge Andrews in her presentation to the court on impounding or forfeiting forfeiture of the vehicle require that the person have more screening and alcohol training. Unfortunately, until that person wants to be rehabilitated, you're just wasting your time. We believe that it needs to be done, but we believe that the person has to want to be rehabilitated. We feel that part of that demand to be rehabilitated will be because of very strong deterrence, very strong, effective deterrence. Listen to the breakdown by Dr. Kelso on the methods of deterrence. Certainty. We certainly do want the certainty to be there. We want the person, when they are arrested for DWI, to be hurt. Not physically hurt. You know, if they are, that's their problem, not ours. You know, if we want them to be perhaps financially stung, to be embarrassed in the community, if they feel that way, we want them to be kept away from the method that they have just employed. If they are taken before a magistrate and the magistrate gives them an OR release or a third party release, oftentimes if they're involved in an accident, they're back on the street before the person who's in surgery is even finished with surgery. That's somehow not fair to the people that have been involved, and it's definitely not fair to the citizens who are still driving on the roads, who still have a drunk driver driving at them. I'm sure you've seen the ads that the state troopers have put on about the gun in the car, about the number of people who've been killed with a gun, the number of people who've been killed with a car. The car is definitely a lethal weapon. You'll hear from victims here, you've heard from some, you'll hear from more, and they can tell you it's a lethal weapon. If you haven't been involved in an accident with a DWI where you've been injured or seriously harmed, I don't know how to tell you. I was very young, the first time I was ever involved with one, but I wasn't hurt, so it was fortunate. But I'm going to say, I'm not a physical victim. I've never been harmed physically myself. And fortunately, I've never had anybody in my family killed. But I do, unfortunately, go and see dead bodies in the road. You know, 40 or 50 accidents a year is enough to make anybody hard on drunk drivers. The method that Dr. Kelso was, I think, trying to say is that deterrence isn't the answer. We think deterrence is a very significant part of the answer. We agree that society has a problem. Society is the problem, and the fact that it's okay to drink and drive, it's okay just to drink in the state of Alaska. We would very much like to see that reversed, that it's not okay to drink and drive. We agree with most of the issues that Dr. Kelso brought out as far as raising the price of alcohol, reducing the number of outlets, reducing the hours of operation, raising the age of consumption, and the public education information methods, and the dram shop legislation. We're all in favor of that. Dr. Wilson mentioned lowering the implied VA of 0.04 or 0.05. We're not quite that strict. We'd like to see it 0.08. It's a medically proven fact that at 0.08, anybody is actually under the influence of alcohol. 0.05 in many of the European countries is at the point of absolute in incarceration. Some of the Scandinavian countries, if you're 0.05, it's 1 year in jail, period. And as I understand, some of the countries, the European countries, if you're DWI and you commit a manslaughter, it's a capital offense. Maybe that's what we need here. That's maybe pretty strict, and that's really out of the issue. What we're asking right here is, you know, we're not asking necessarily a capital offense, but we think that the community as a whole is demanding and anticipating and will be highly upset if we don't get some strong legislation requiring some strong commitment of the Senate, of the state. It's a pleasure to talk to you because we've talked to the House before, and we thought, as June said, that we were getting excellent support. Only now, politics being what politics are, for whatever reason, not being involved to the extent that you find folks are, we feel that you're playing with an issue that's really some people's lives. We feel that had MAD maybe been more effective earlier, and unfortunately MAD can't do anything until the victims do something. Had it been effective, maybe we wouldn't have had some of the deaths that we've had. We realize and we recognize when you start talking about some of the ways to take care of it and the cost-benefit approaches, that it's a very costly, extremely costly thing to the state, to the various local governments, to require enforcement, to require more judges, to require more prisons, to require that something be done. We recognize that the state is undergoing a period of declining revenues. However, we believe that it is in the state's interest and it's the demand of the state's population that the monies that you are dispersing be dispersed into an increased program, such as some of the programs that are before you now. You heard from other people, and you'll hear from more people, about the judges letting people out. Notwithstanding the fact that there's a separation of powers in the state, we believe that the judges have been too damn lenient. And we don't think that they have the right to release people after they've infringed on somebody else's rights by running into them because they're afraid of that person's own civil rights. Not being an attorney, such as certain members here are, I really don't know how much civil rights a person is supposed to have. But once they run into somebody, as far as I'm concerned, they don't have any more. And once they've been found guilty, they shouldn't have any because they've already been judged not to have the right to do what they did. We think that strong penalties such as long times in jail, hefty fines, forfeiture of the vehicle, immediate impoundment right then and there, and we would like to see at the moment that they're arrested, that they be taken before the judge then. And if they want a jury trial, let them have a jury trial at midnight, if that's what it means. And let them stand before the jury, puking all over the floor, trying to tell them they're not drunk. Let them have their defense attorney, if there is such an animal that come out that time of night, let them come out and say, oh no, that person's not drunk, and have them actually look and see right then and there. You talk about speedy justice. There it is. In fact, the odds are most people would go ahead and say, I'm guilty, because no attorney's going to come out and say, oh, this guy's not guilty when he's standing there, maybe not even standing, and sitting there with his eyes all watery, unable to recite the alphabet, the standard thing about you're trying to, when an officer makes a stop under whatever reason, probable cause, notwithstanding, for whatever reason he's been stopped, and you hear the story that a person is trying to be confused, I want you to count backwards from 50, and you say, well, I can't do that, I can't, you're trying to confuse me. The driver has no rights. The driver does not have the privilege to drive under the influence. Driving is a right of licensed drivers only, and the society has a right to demand that those licensed drivers be responsible, and if they're not, that they be put away someplace, harmed someplace, that they don't do it again. We feel that strong deterrence is the primary method. If, as Dr. Indell had mentioned Thursday, that they bring down one of the pipeline camps from whoever they decide to buy it from, it's fine. For 72 hours, we could have some people cleaning up our roads. You've all driven around. You see how filthy they are. Unfortunately, the people, like Dr. Wilson said, they love to throw their beer bottles and pop bottles and everything out. Maybe these fine folks should be out there cleaning the roads. Make them wear red hats. Make everybody know. Maybe take pictures of them. We are in the process now of trying to get from the municipality of Anchorage the permission to post every week the 24-hour log for all DWI arrests. We don't mean convictions. Wait till they're convicted. We want the public to see who's been arrested for DWI. I don't know that it's an issue that we can get. Was before the election that he was all in favor of us, but now for some reason he doesn't have as much time for us or for our issue. We're hoping that a committee such as yours has some type of influence with the governor to ask for this type of a commission. We want the public to be aware of the drunk driving issue at all times. We feel that it will in fact happen. Another thing we're also concerned about is mandatory insurance. Most of the accidents occur, and unfortunately, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to estimate that over half of all accidents occur happen with drivers who are not insured. We would like to require mandatory insurance. There has been a bill drafted, and I don't know what the status on it is at this point, as to who has it, that we drafted, that had several ways of going about requiring a state to have mandatory insurance. I understand that the House, it was one of their issues. I don't know if it made it to the Senate or not. I'm running out of ideas here. At this point, I think I'm probably going to stop.
Thank you very much. Let me first ask you to give your address. We have to have it for the record under our rules.
Okay, Star Out Box 192A, Eagle River, 99587. I thought it was on there from yesterday.
I don't have it on this list. Let me say that from what I heard Dr. Kelso say, it was not that deterrence is not the answer. He was saying, I think, that deterrence alone is not the answer. That I don't think he was speaking against deterrence. He was just saying, in addition to deterrence, you have to deal with rehabilitation, with prevention, and lots of other things. And I don't think you disagree with that.
We definitely don't disagree. The impression in listening to Dr. Kelso was that I have, and I think that June has, because we were sitting there both making notes with our eyebrows raised, was that perhaps the state should not put as much emphasis on deterrence as it does now in lieu of some of the others. We don't want to give up what we have. We'd ask for more, and that's what in approaching the fiscal note on this, and I don't know how many dollars there really are involved, you know, we're aware that it's a mega dollar situation, is that we think there should be more dollars put in, because we feel it's one of the primary problems that the state of Alaska has to address. I'm a very conservative person, and I don't like the idea of spending state dollars recklessly and needlessly. I think that there's very strong needs that the community has, both for capital needs and for operations needs. But we feel that the dollars spent in this, whether not be just awareness or deterrence, but that all of the issues that Dr. Kelso had asked for all need an upgrade in the dollars. So that they're all upgraded.
Let me say this. I'm personally in full agreement with you, because I think that money spent on human, on social issues, is really carrying out the principal responsibility of state and local government. So that to me, this fits right in there. I want to assure you that we have people come in with just as fervent a plea. Speaking in behalf of the physically disabled, in behalf of the senior citizens, in behalf of little children, foster children, and so on. So that we have a lot of these appeals, and there are a lot of priorities, and I understand exactly what you're saying. Let me ask Dennis Kelso if he wants to clarify.
Yeah, I would like to. I hope it wasn't a misunderstanding, but I think the first thing that deterrence has a demonstrated effect, and that's one of the first points that I made, is that as long as it meets the criteria of being certain and swift and severe, that we can count on there being an effect in the drinking driving statistic indicators going down. But the point is that it quickly dies out. And so you either end up in a position of constantly having to increase penalty, severity, and certainty every time in order to keep the effect, or go to some other measure. And so you have, when you put the two of them together, it's not that deterrence works, but that just don't put your hopes for the long term on a deterrent model. Short term, absolutely, you've got all the evidence that says it works. But what do you do afterward? What do you do in 6 months? And that was the main point that I was making.
Thank you very much. Then. I want to just, before Senator Rohde goes on, I want to, for the record, state that Senator Arla Sturgiluski is present.
Okay,
sent already.
Just brief, when you add enforcement to the deterrent, though, in the long range, do your studies show that that increases the effectiveness of tough penalties?
In fact, that seems to be the key. The certainty has led less to do with conviction and jail penalties and more to do with apprehension and arrest.
That seems to be a major part of what we're grappling with, how to be as effective as possible in enforcement.
Right, and so that the notion from the deterrent model of certainty is that probability of being apprehended, the perception of it, has to be very high in the public. Now, if it's only high for those people that get convicted of the severity of the punishment, then basically the population that would affect is the people that get arrested. And that's not the general deterrent. What you want to get at is the people that could potentially be arrested if you want their perceptions to be altered. So that comes from the probability of arrest, at least according to what we know from research.
Thank you.
But I understand in the Anchorage area that the odds are like 1,200 to 1. I think that's the numbers that have been worked up because of the alcohol program APD is involved with. The 1,200 to 1, like Dr. Kelso says, is not good enough.
That's right.
And again, not knowing that the number of dollars you're looking at on the fiscal note, we would ask for, we wish we were in a position to demand that the dollars be spent under all of the efforts Dr. Kelso has mentioned. Increased enforcement, such as roadblocks. My work is hand in hand with the Anchorage Police Department and the state troopers, and I know how short-staffed they really are. And I know how much they actually personally care to address this problem, but there's other things they also have to do. And I know how much they could use more manpower, more effective alcohol programs. There's nothing that they'd rather see. Nothing I'd rather do than not get a telephone call at 2:00 in the morning and have to go out and look for somebody that's smashed in a car.
Let me mention, make a reference to one of your suggestions, and that's a task force. It's something that we've been considering also, and I'll certainly talk to the governor about it. He can do it very easily. For us to initiate it, we have to pass a resolution or a law. My last comment on your testimony, which was very good and very forceful, is that while I go along with your thrust and your dedication, I think that none of us can expect the rights guaranteed to individuals under U.S. Constitution to be abrogated, even in the case of drunk driving, because even if you hold a midnight jury trial, the person will be out in the street the next day, so it's better to follow constitutional guidelines on individual rights than have quick justice that doesn't stand up.
Well, if I could, in the issue of that I brought up about trying people immediately, while there still are, in fact, probably under the influence, Dr. Kelso brought out the fact that at 0.20 they're stopped at midnight, or they go home at 0.20, and in fact, if they're 0.13 at 7 o'clock in the morning, they go to work. If they're convicted, then we feel that they should be starting their sentence right then and there. No time to arrange their personal life, because they voluntarily got behind the car. Nobody is forced to get behind the wheel, and we think that they have voluntarily given up the right to do something else.
Okay.
Subject
to the Supreme Court.
guarantees.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Chuck. Please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Sarah Colby, STOLTE. I'm a resident of Anchorage. I didn't realize that this meeting was going to be held until last night. I do not have prepared remarks, but I have 3 points that I would like to make briefly. First, speaking as a private citizen and as a parent of 4 daughters, whose ages are 16, 22, and I mentioned their ages because we have we have dealt with coming of age and getting driver's licenses
and drinking responsibly, driving responsibly. And I've spent a considerable amount of time around young people, both as a parent and in various capacities. I am in favor of raising the drinking age to 21. I cannot say how strongly I am in favor of that. For all of the reasons that have been mentioned, and it isn't necessary for me to repeat them, with one exception that I've never heard mentioned, and that is mainly why I wanted to briefly speak to you this morning. There's no end to the sources that a young person has if they wish to drink. It's incredible to me, the sources available. And I don't disagree with the gentleman who spoke about adults selling it to them. It's available in the homes. Those parents that drink, the kids can get it there, and they talk about it freely, how they can get into their parents' liquor. Older brothers and sisters purchase it for them. Drinking is considered, in my observations, drinking is considered a rite of passage. It's the usual thing. It's what one does when one grows up. And if you don't, then you're not considered with it. And the peer pressure to drink is incredible. It astounds me as a parent. But one of the things I haven't heard mentioned is the availability of false ID. Now, I don't have any sources for this, but I know that it is available, and I know the kids can easily get it, and I know that they easily use it. And my feeling, in addition to all of the other arguments for raising the drinking age, is that if you observe 16, 17, and 18-year-old young people and their physical characteristics, and you observe that same individual at age 21, there is a considerable difference in their physical characteristics. There's a maturing, there's a heaviness about them. The kids that get the false IDs at age 16, 17, and 18 can go into the liquor stores with identification and purchase alcohol. They can go into the bars and purchase alcohol. And I don't think it's realistic or reasonable to assume that the individual behind the counter, in either case, should not look at that ID and accept it. I mean, it's there. It says this person is old enough at age 19 to drink. But if a 16-year-old walks into a liquor store and the drinking age is 21, he's going to look at the 16-year-old and say, no way, because he doesn't even look 21 and probably isn't acting 21 either. But a 16, 17, and 18-year-old could easily pass for 19. And so in your considerations, I would appreciate it if you would keep that thought before you. The two other points that I would make, that I would like to make very briefly. I serve as chairman of the Citizens Advisory Educational Concerns Committee at Service High School. And one of our unit goals this year was to investigate driver education in the high schools as mandatory. And I was interested to note that is being considered at this time. I didn't realize that it had been. We, as a committee, went to the school district, the school board, regarding this, and were told that mandatory driver education in high schools was too expensive and too complicated, and we were given no interest, no encouragement to pursue the matter. Told it had been pursued before, and it wouldn't work, and it's too expensive, and on and on. So I would like to make that point. The additional point I would like to make briefly is we have a group of parents that meet regularly at the service that I've been privileged to put together. And the purpose is to provide a place for parents to speak with parents. And in the context of that meeting, we ask people to fill out an evaluation and interest form on what they'd like to see in the future. Every single meeting that we've had, on the interest part of the form, people want to know more about education, of being educated regarding alcohol use. Well, actually it's drug use, but naturally alcohol falls into the category of drugs, and they mention alcohol. They will say, we want to know more. The reason I bring these two points up is because I think that you will find amongst the parents, at least out of Sir Sanchu, where I am actively involved, I think you will find a very receptive group of people who understand that it is now the time to educate our young people and their parents about the responsible use of alcohol and the responsible use of a driver's license. I don't think that the average young person considers the acquisition of a driver's license as a responsibility. I think they see it as a rite of passage. Age 16, I get my driver's license. Nobody ever talks to me about responsibility unless it's their parents.
Thank you very much. This is very, very useful. And it ties in with what Chuck was talking about before in terms of the cost of doing this. Senate Bill 226, which is actually entitled regarding training and licensing of drivers and establishing the curfew, establishing curfews, would provide that in order to obtain a provisional permit, provisional license, youthful applicants would have to have training. They would have, there'd be several levels, and training would give them a rite of passage into the higher level, would relieve them of as tight a curfew requirement as might apply to others. We got a fiscal note, that's the cost of the measure, just before I left yesterday, and I didn't have a chance to really take a look at it or even take it with me, but it was something like $1.5 million. Well, a bill that comes along, you know, that has that much for, it's for training, there's that much for driver training, is going to run into the kind of problem that you have run into. And I hope that, you know, if MAD and other groups really care enough about this, that you will again let your legislators know that this is a priority. I fully agree with you. The problem is that kids consider this, you know, a right. And we had testimony on this last year when we were considering the drinking age bill, that one mother was saying the key really is not at what age they drink, at what age they drive. And if you could take the driving privilege away, that is really the most important issue with them. The drinking is sort of an aggravation, but the key thing is driving. And I think that addressing that issue is simply critical, and I'm glad you brought it up. And we need your address, please.
Star Roadie.
Senator Rohde?
Just let me follow up on the driver's ed comment. Because the studies indicate that driver's ed alone, if it's not correlated with age, actually increases accidents because it puts more young people on the road. It's kind of an ironic
thing.
Say again. The driver's education, by virtue of putting more young people on the road at an earlier age, if it does that, will actually increase accidents.
How does it put more in the process of learning to drive, or how?
In the process of learning to drive, I can only tell you what the studies that I have seen have shown me, but the caveat is that unless it's correlated with age, if you offer driver's ed at the minimal age for driving, rather than perhaps up a year or two, It's not as effective, and I think we have to look at that. And I share Senator Fisher's concern that we need to spend some money in that area. It's obviously an area for not only public education but public protection.
And
so, I hope you'll take a look at some of the studies that have been done in the area, as I have over when I chair Judiciary. In that,
it's such a simple thing. If I may just,
please,
it's
go
such
ahead.
A simple thing to get a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a simple thing to consider getting a driver's license. My youngest just got hers this week. It was an accepted thing to do. Now, we have really pretty strong house rules on certain things regarding driving and drinking, but and driving, period. But you don't hear that kind of thing from the kids as a rule. And I was extremely interested in the remarks by Professor, because I think all of the things that Mad wants to do, and I support him wholly and 100%, are so important. But if the education is not there, if it is not assumed that a child is going to go, a young person is going to go out on graduation night and drink themselves senseless, it is assumed that they will do that. Nobody gives it a second thought that they're going to do that. And they're going to be driving when they do it. Graduation night is... Anyway, it's the acceptance of it. And the other part of it is not only education of young people, it's the education of the parents about their responsibilities when it comes to the driver's license. And the green card.
Just went through with my oldest daughter, so.
I
know.
thank you very much. We have a few minutes left. There's a hand raised, two hands, three hands, four. You have to talk before noon? No, I'm just asking. Hands are raised. Those are people who have to speak now. They cannot be back this afternoon. All right. Can we keep these real brief now? Come on up. Give your name, address if you haven't registered in, and we'll try and run through very quickly. You're next.
My name is Carl Shadbetter. I live at 1433 West 9th and Entry. I'm a member of MAD. I'm here as an insurance citizen. I joined MAD to financial support. I'm not attending the meeting. I subscribe to the comments made by Mr. Landers and other members of that organization. I believe that we should have a very strong deterrent for drunk driving. I think that should be the strongest emphasis that we have. I do not believe that education and rehabilitation will be successful unless a person wants to accept it. You surely know that Alcoholics Anonymous is the most successful organization to treat acute alcoholism. Mm-hmm. But a person cannot succeed in that organization unless he stands up and says, I am an alcoholic, and he wants help. I do not want the state to be involved in expensive rehabilitation programs trying to help these people if they don't want to be helped. I have three adult children. When they became 16, they knew they were going to get a license to drive an automobile. I paid for professional driver assistance for them. They are good drivers. They do not have the attitude that I really would respect from them if they were so careful about drinking or driving. They think that's an accepted way and thing for them to do. Fortunately, they've never been involved in an accident or hurt anybody. I personally lost two automobiles and I've been physically injured by drunk drivers. The second one that hit me was on the street with a rented automobile within 3 hours of the time he hit me, and he was so pickled he couldn't stand up. And I'm mad, and I think that we need to do something. I think we need to treat this on a very severe manner. One comment. I think that you should not extend to the judiciary or to the incarceration or the enforcement system the latitude they now have in the way they treat drunks. Judges in Anchorage say, I don't want to incarcerate these people because no one's going to treat them while they're in jail. I don't care if they don't get treated. I think you need to tell those people, you pay for your treatment and you get your treatment or you're going to suffer severe financial losses. I know that young people in my children who are well-educated, but even those who are not well-educated, are impressed if they're going to lose something. They're impressed by financial losses. And I think they would be impressed if you have severe penalties.
Thank you very much. Sir? No, we haven't got time.
My name is Gary Fye, and I operate Gary T. Fye Company, which is a fire and accident investigation firm. I investigate accidents for law firms and for insurance companies here in Alaska and around the Northwest. I had three pages prepared, but I'll go down just a couple points that I think might be helpful. And I want to say before I start that it's taken me 22 years to understand what Dr. Kelso has outlined in 15 minutes, and I'm very impressed. Thanks for doing that. The issue that is on my mind most of all is that the Alcohol Beverage Control Board has pretty much escaped any criticism on this whole issue, and that no litigation is needed to establish a policy decision to do something about vendors who provide alcohol to abusers. And it would take a senatorial telephone call to change that. And that's not litigation, it's not legislation, it's just simply a matter of policy. And for some reason, there's been an interruption of the removal of licenses of vendors where there has been a clear abuse of the privilege. I'll get off that to another point. Driving records are currently secret. Driving records should be made available to employers and insurance companies on a wide open basis. And the people who have bad driving records have also abused their privilege of driving. They should suffer the economic censure that would follow that kind of behavior. My next point is that major citations, such as eluding, leaving the scene of an accident, and even though it's not a citation up here, open container, speed contest, I hold these in the same esteem that I hold drunk driving, and I think that the investigating officer should be empowered to put the driver's licenses of the suspect on his accident report and give it to the district attorney, where it will be held pending any criminal determination. Again, driving is a privilege. It can be removed administratively simply as a policy matter. The role of the motor vehicle department in all of these traffic violations has been greatly underrated and greatly neglected. But like this gracious lady said before me, it's appalling that we so easily let people operate a dangerous instrumentality. Chuck Landers called it a lethal weapon, and he and I know that that's true. An automobile is a very lethal instrument, and we casually put it in the hands of people who aren't equipped to handle it properly. We can change that as a policy matter, not through legislation or through litigation. It's simply a matter of policy. I advocate mandatory automobile insurance, but if no one salutes that flag, my feeling is that the insurers who do write automobile insurance should be forced by department policy to include underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage. The public is almost completely ignorant of that field of insurance or how cheap it is, and yet how much protection it provides. As I've stated, I oppose open container allowance here in the state. That's asking for trouble. We all know it's asking for trouble. It's clearly an area of permissiveness that has led to much harm. On the issue of curfews, I have teenagers who drive, and the curfews, I think, would be a tremendous burden, undeserved burden on them. I oppose the curfews. I was against the lowering of the age to 19. I guess I'm for raising it, but I've had mixed emotions until I heard the lady before me speak. Now I'm really strongly for that. Her views I hadn't considered, and I really appreciate hearing those. I have a cheap shot to take, and I apologize in advance to the crowd, and you'll have to forgive me and remember that I am a sleazy accident investigator. I read in the paper this morning that one of the organizations represented here, I believe, I hope I have this straight, the Council on Prevention of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, has given an award to a vendor. 2 days ago, I read in the paper that an 8-year-old in Russian Mission died from alcohol consumption. And the troopers were trying to determine where the alcohol came from. You senators have all been at Wien Airline in the morning and seen the liquor vans pile up in front of their terminal to go to Bethel. I think that we personally have avoided the moral choices and the judgments that are necessary to stop that kind of thing. Those communities out there have made sales illegal, and yet we casually condone the importation and we facilitate it. It was something I considered as a personal affront when I see that an organization which should be sophisticated about alcohol abuse and drug abuse is giving awards to the people responsible for it. Unless you have any questions, that's all I have.
I have one question. With regard to curfew, do you think it's unreasonable to limit 18-year-old drivers from driving between midnight and, let's say, 6 a.m. or on Friday and Saturday nights when we have the highest accident rate involving those the age groups?
Yes, for the reason that this is America. Some of the well-meant but inflammatory comments earlier, I think if some of the people remember that it's America, will agree that we have good, adequate laws on the books. It's a matrix for which responsible behavior can happen. To try to alter our way of life by turning us into a police state or by trying to imply that the police agencies are responsible for parenting and remedying all of these ills that we've caused by our bad examples, we've departed from what our American goals are.
Well, no, wait a minute. There's no God-given or constitutionally given right to drive a vehicle, and certainly to drive a vehicle and cause accidents, or to drink, or anything of that sort. And we have all sorts of restrictions on individual freedoms. We can't carry concealed weapons, there are lots of other things we can't do. And especially when there's a direct correlation between, let's say, accidents and the hours of driving. The drag strip on Benson, for instance, and Northern Lights is a perfect example. As was suggested earlier, if we could close that down, if we could limit that kind of drag racing, just racing around crazily late at night, it would save lives, it would keep people from being injured. I mean, how could you say that it would be un-American to limit people from driving, whereas it's American to keep them from drinking? I mean, both are privileges that society can withhold from certain groups.
I refuse to let those jerks on Northern Lights intrude on my freedoms any more than they already have. If I come in from a camping trip in an airplane at 2 o'clock in the morning and my 16-year-old is the only one available to come pick me up, I want her to be feel free to operate her car on a highway, enjoying police protection. I think that the trade-off is not worth it. You're talking about kids that need some parental discipline, some more understanding, some maturing, and I don't think we should pass state laws for an Anchorage problem.
All right, let me give you the other side again. We've had young people appearing before us God-fearing, upstanding young people who say, why should they not be able to have a social drink, let's say after prom night in a restaurant somewhere, if they're 19 years of age, just because a few people transgress on, you know, our restrictions or on are unable to drink properly, that their whole classes of people who are improperly being restricted is what their argument goes, and why should they be punished because of the transgressions of a few? I mean, you say one is right, the other is wrong.
Well, I think you just made my argument for me. I'm saying that when you impose a code of behavior on all, you've made the majority conform to rules that are necessary for the minority. And when the minority deprives you of freedom like that, it's not right. It opposes our ideals.
Well, but isn't that true? We tell young people that you're old enough to vote, you're old enough to fight for your country, to defend your country, you're old enough to hold a job, to make a living, to raise a family, do everything, but you may not drink. And that's only because a few jackasses don't know how to drink and drive.
Yeah. I wish that we could have a society where there was no drinking age, where there was such familial support that we didn't have to have a law regarding a drinking age at all, that there would simply be a societal responsibility that was so strong and so supportive that no age would work. I don't like the idea of juggling the age. If you want to impose ages on conduct, I guess I support raising them. I support letting 18-year-olds have the driving privilege rather than 16-year-olds.
All right. Let me mention that. I mentioned earlier the statistics that we have a higher rate of, have had a higher rate of fatal crashes involving 18 kids, 18 and younger, than 19 and 20-year-olds. Let me give you another statistic. This is for 16-year-olds involved in crashes. It was mentioned Maryland had a drastic reduction when they established curfew hours. They had a 40% reduction of crashes during of accidents during curfew hours. New York has had a 62% reduction. Pennsylvania had a 69% reduction in accidents. That's a pretty damn impressive statistic.
I don't want to live in New York.
All right. I don't want to pursue. Thank you very much for your testimony. The gentleman in the blue sweater. Yes. Those who haven't signed up or do speak, would you please sign up in the back just so we have a full record? Please go ahead.
My name is Fred Brantingham, and it's Brantingham, and I signed up in the back.
Good. Sure.
Thank you for allowing me to talk at this time. I'll try to keep it brief and sort of talk with you. I think that I favor the increase of drinking age as being the parent of a 19-year-old son, and as being the parent of a 15-year-old daughter who was murdered 2 years ago in drunk driving collision. Actually, it's a year and a half ago. In that specific instance, the individual who committed the murder, and I use that in a legal sense since he was found guilty of murder and is certainly currently in jail, he was 19 years old, and had this law been in effect as the circumstances came out during his trial, given his family circumstances and given the kind of the society that he was living in, that my daughter currently would be alive because he would not have been drinking that night. And in addition, the lady who was driving the car, a close friend of ours, would also be alive as a result of that. I think in that specific instance, it greatly, I think that specific instance illustrates the effect that raising the drinking age would have, because what it does is that most people, I think, are responsible enough to try to obey the law. Certainly there will be a certain number of people who will break the lock, as you will, and go through the door into the place that they shouldn't be. But most people, when they find that door locked, will obey the lock and not commit the crime. I'm also in favor of forfeiture of a motor vehicle. And again, in this specific instance, this particular individual's comment when he was told that he had just seriously injured two people was, well, those damn people don't have to make the mortgage payments on my truck. And that was his reaction. The most important thing in his life was the ability to drive his Datsun pickup truck, and he worked to support that vehicle. That was the total orientation. Realizing that he was going to lose that motor vehicle in the event that he behaved in an irresponsible fashion, I think would have served as a deterrent to him, because this individual is not stupid. Irresponsible, dangerous, yes, stupid, no. In addition, something that has not been mentioned yet today is that we have in this country probably a most effective intelligence network anywhere called the credit reporting system. I think the one way in which to get the financial institutions and be involved and in turn have a ripple effect in society is to make a lender realize that they could be left holding the bag for a vehicle that is confiscated as a result of a drunk driving incident. That means then that an individual who has an alcohol problem, who has not been put into a position yet where they are motivated enough to seek help for that alcohol problem, couldn't get a mortgage or couldn't get a loan to buy a car because the lender just would not lend the money for that purpose. I think that it's that kind of a thing which would, in this particular case, have prevented him from owning the vehicle in the first place. And secondly, I think that would have a ripple effect throughout society, because we would then have responsible business elements of our society involved with trying to do something so that they could keep on in business. In addition, I think it's fairly well established that you cannot really rehabilitate a person unless they want to be rehabilitated. Given an individual's desire to own a motor vehicle and to operate a motor vehicle, I think that the confiscation law would lend an awful lot of assistance to the motivation of people to seek assistance. And so in those two actions, I think that would really, obviously not favor those. One thing that I also favor is something that has not been mentioned, and that is that that has to do with cost. Certainly it's expensive. Any kind of a program that we have is expensive. And to put it in sort of a personal light, what's happened to us over the last year and a half in my personal family has not exactly been cheap, either financially or emotionally. And I'm here to tell you that dollars don't count. I think that the effect of a user fee or something of that nature on the product which is being sold would have that fee to be, proceeds would be used to pay for all of the alcohol-related activity in the state, I think would be very effective. And it would be effective in the same way that some people, I think it would be effective in the way that some people, when will only respond to dollars in the pocketbook. If a liquor establishment or drive-in store or whatever has to tack on another 2 or 3 or 4% onto the price of the product they sell in order to generate enough revenue to pay for the incarceration of drunk drivers, in order to pay for the rehabilitation programs, the legal system, I think that they would immediately have a financial incentive in order to reduce that particular cost, because they're interested in doing one thing, they're interested in selling booze. And obviously when you raise the price of it, that's going to reduce the ability to do that. So those are three things that that I favor, and I favor them for the specific instances that I cited. It was rather ironic because all this happened to me because ever since I was been put into any kind of a supervisory kind of role, I really haven't liked drunk drivers very much, and. A short time before our daughter was murdered, as a matter of fact, I was being very highly critical of our of the state's activities regarding drunk drivers. So, but that.